You're listening to an American Free Press podcast. Joining me on the phone from Helena, Montana is Elo Jones, the executive director of the Fully Informed Jury Association. Elo, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to visit with you today, and I'm very happy to be with you and talk about FIJA and our mission and why we exist.
What is the Fully Informed Jury Association?
The Fully Informed Jury Association was started more than 20 years ago by two fellows who were both libertarians who realized, after talking with some other people, that one of the veto powers of the citizenry, which is, you know, you can always vote people out of office and that sort of thing,
right.
But that the citizens of this country also had the ability when they served as jurors to refuse to enforce bad laws or bad prosecutions of good laws. And jurors were never told about this anymore. They haven't been told about it for a long time for a variety of reasons. So these two fellows founded the Fully Informed Jury Association as an educational outreach organization to teach the general public about their authority and responsibility as a juror to render a verdict based on conscience and to use their own sense of justice rather than simply relying upon the importunings of the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge, all of whom may have a vested interest in the outcome of the trial, whereas the jurors are there, more or less objective members of the community, are there just to serve justice. And so they are able to have a more objective, reasoned approach to the outcome of the trial and may be able to spare many people who are unfairly prosecuted or prosecuted under bad laws, having their human rights violated by the government and being imprisoned or heavily fined.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they still have to go through the entire onerous task of a trial and its financial burden. Nonetheless, jurors have the authority to refuse to convict people who have not harmed any other person. If there is no victim, then there is no crime. And so we tell people that, and we tell them as jurors, they must consider their own sense of justice. They must consult with their own conscience. They must refuse to render a verdict, even if the facts in the case support the fact that this person did, in fact, break a law. And I'm using the word fact many times because jurors are mostly told that they're to judge only the facts and must take the law as given to them by the judge. And that is not true.
Mm.
And the entire history of juries, back to the Magna Carta, is centered around this authority of the juror to refuse to enforce bad laws or malicious prosecutions.
All the way back to, when is that, 12, what?
The Magna Carta was 1215.
Wow, and it goes back to the Magna. So juries go back
at least that far. Yeah.
Would you be so kind as to give our listeners a little history on juries from the Magna Carta?
I'd be happy to.
Great.
Yeah. When the Magna Carta was written and signed by King John, of course, who was, you know, really a predatory kind of king and was snatching land and monies from people under his reign. That was a monarchy. That's the same thing can happen in any form of government, not just under kings, as we know very well in this country.
Right.
How much of our money is snatched.
Right.
But anyway, during that time, the peers, the titled people, were the ones being most preyed upon at that level by the king. And so they rebelled, and they came together and forced King John to sign an agreement which said, among other things, that if a law was enacted and they were being tried under that law, which usually meant that they were being punished because they had made the king angry, or the king was trying to confiscate some of their property, it was an early form of asset forfeiture,
mm-hmm.
by the way, that they had the right to a trial by jury of their peers, and in this case, that meant other titled and landed people. So they had a right to a jury of their peers to determine whether or not the king was actually entitled to take this action against the person. So whenever government would try to impose its will upon them unjustly and unfairly, which was in most instances,
right.
they had the right to trial by jury. The jury had a different role back then. The jury often did gather the facts and bring in witnesses and that sort of thing. The role of the jury from 1215 up until the 1600s changed. It fluctuated over time as there was this tension, this tug of war between the power of the jury to nullify or veto, which means to refuse to enforce a law in a particular case, to nullify, in this case, the actions of the government, or to veto the law the government is trying to impose. That would sometimes be the jury would have more power to do that, and at sometimes juries were less able to do that, and it reached the point where jurors were often threatened by the king's judges, by the government judges, that if they didn't follow the law as it was given to them by the judge, even even back then, now remember we're talking about the 14th and 15th and 16th and 17th century, if they didn't follow the law, they could be punished. And so jurors were put in a very difficult position because if they consulted their own conscience and rendered a verdict based on conscience and their own sense of justice and right and wrong, they might be thrown into jail. They might have their land seized in turn.
Right.
And so this was a pushback by government against the power of the jurors to veto bad laws and bad prosecutions. So anyway, there was this tug of war going on between government and the people living inside the jurisdiction of that government. And that tug of war manifested itself between the juries and the government. And the influence of each waxed and waned within the judicial system until about 1670, when a number of instances, a number of cases, and especially the case of William Penn, brought up before the courts the question of whether or not jurors could be, in fact, be punished for their verdict if they did not obey the government judge. And at that time, Justice Vaughan, who was head of the Court of Common Pleas, which was like the Supreme Court in England, said that jurors could not be punished for their verdict. And there is a lot about that case that has been written. This was the case of William Penn, and if that name sounds familiar, it's because he later came to the colonies, founded Pennsylvania, and instituted much of human rights within that colony early on because he was a Quaker.
He was a giant.
He was, yes. For human rights especially. But during colonial America, there were many cases of jurors refusing to enforce or vetoing or nullifying bad laws and bad prosecutions. There was a publisher in New York, in colonial New York, who criticized the king's appointed governor of colonial New York, and he criticized him by simply citing many truthful facts. The publisher, Mr. John Zinger, was brought to trial, and the jury refused to convict him, even though he had, in fact, said these bad things about the governor. And at that time, by the way, truth was no defense. They decided that since he was telling the truth, that he could not be found guilty of libel, and so they refused to convict him. And a little earlier than that, during the Salem witch trials, which existed in what was basically a colony that was a theocracy, their form of government was pretty much a theocracy, there were many witch trials in Salem, and they finally ended because the people just grew weary of this, and in case after case, for almost 30 cases, the jury refused to convict anyone. And so they had to just drop the law, drop the prosecutions, because they weren't able to get it enforced anymore. And that's fairly common in the history of our nation, beginning in colonial times. During the Whiskey Rebellion, which happened right after the Revolutionary War, our nation was in debt. George Washington decided an excellent way to obtain revenue was to tax the corn farmers of Pennsylvania who converted their corn into corn whiskey because, of course, it kept better and it was easier to transport to market. So Washington decided to impose a tax on them, and that resulted in the Whiskey Rebellion.
Ah, I remember that from school.
Yes. Well, what they didn't teach you about the Whiskey Rebellion and the people who rebelled against this tax on their corn liquor, which was an unfair tax, is that when the whiskey rebels were brought to trial, none of them were convicted. The juries refused to convict them, and the whiskey tax had to be abandoned because they couldn't enforce it. By the time we were dealing with the years before the Civil War, the Fugitive Slave Act had been put in place, and I'm sure you learned about this as well.
Yes.
The Fugitive Slave Act said that anybody who escaped, any human being who was property of some other individual, had to be sent back to the owner of the property, and anyone who harbored that escaped individual could also be prosecuted for harboring a slave and contributing to the escape of property of another person. Especially in Quaker communities, juries refused to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act. They simply refused to find anyone guilty.
Right.
And the law, therefore, could not be enforced. Now, you must remember that at that time, the federal government enforced the Federal Slave Act. This was an act enforced by the government that one human could own another, and that if the human who was being held under this type of ownership tried to escape, the government would capture them and send them back, and would also punish anyone who tried to help this human being to escape from slavery.
Right.
This was the government doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the jury refused to convict, this was, again, that strong tension, that push and pull, that tug of war between the government and individual humans based on matters of conscience.
Right.
This is the history of jury nullification in our country.
Jury nullification.
Jury nullification. holding the law as naught, as being not applicable, not capable of having any power, as nothing in that particular case.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Jury nullification, the act of one individual of conscience, well, we hope of conscience, who refuses to enforce a law they believe violates some individual civil human rights.
Okay, and jury nullification has existed all the way back to the Magna Carta in 1215.
Yes. It is one of the pillars of the foundational precepts of the common law.
Okay, and even in our country, I have a quote here from John Jay, 1794, when he was the Chief Justice of the U.S., he was the first Chief Justice of the United States, and a founding father, right, and the President of the Continental Congress, and he co-wrote the Federalist Papers with Hamilton and Madison. He said, "It is presumed that juries are the best judges of facts. It is, on the other hand, presumed that courts are the best judges of law. But still, both objects are within your power of decision. You, juries, have a right to take it upon yourselves to judge both and to determine the law as well as the fact in controversy."
Exactly. And John Adams said that jurors have a right to render a verdict based on conscience, even if in direct contradiction to the instructions of the judge.
John Adams said that?
John Adams said that.
Okay. So it has a deep history in our...
Yes,
in our...
And Thomas Jefferson said, in a famous quote, which we, of course, have on our stationery, said in a letter, and I'm quoting, "I consider trial by jury as the only anchor yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution."
It's powerful.
When this country was founded, and especially when the Bill of Rights was being written, which, of course, as we all know, is a bill of limitations on the government, that they may not do certain things and they may not interfere with certain human rights.
Mm-hmm.
When they talk about the jury, they're talking about a group of people who had it in their power to judge and were expected to judge both the facts and the law in every case brought before them.
Okay. So we went through the Magna Carta, William Penn, John Zinger, that publisher, then the Salem Witch Trials, the Whiskey Rebellion, and the Fugitive Slave Act.
And now we're up to about 1850, and now we're focused in on the struggle for the balance of power between individuals and the government that controls the political entity of the land in which they live, the territory in which they live. We know that there was still slavery in this country, that it was condoned and protected by the government.
Mm-hmm.
Under political compromises between politicians.
Okay.
By 1895, after the Civil War was over, and the southern states, which had tried to remove themselves through state-level nullification to avoid the unfair taxation in the South. By the way, the war wasn't started over slavery, and you probably already know that.
Yeah.
But it was certainly an issue. It was certainly an issue. And so after the Civil War, everybody now in the United States is considered a free human being.
Mm-hmm.
And there is still this tug of war for the balance of power. Juries are still nullifying laws all across the nation, which they find repugnant to their conscience.
Okay.
And so in 1895, the federal court said that jurors no longer needed to be told by judges or attorneys of the court that they had the authority to judge the law as well as the facts. That it was common knowledge, and that it was no longer incumbent upon the courts to make sure that people understood that they had this authority. And that decision has been used to cause the courts to refuse to allow defense attorneys to even mention jury veto power or jury nullification to jurors in any case. After the end of the Civil War, during Reconstruction, on up until that, let's put 1895 right now as kind of a pivotal date, the federal government was aggressively attempting to consolidate power over the judiciary as well as over the states to create the federalism construct under which we operate today.
And you said that was 1895 and forward, they tried that power grab?
Well, by 1895, the power grab had been successful enough that there were enough members of the Supreme Court that they voted, that they wrote, that jurors no longer needed to be informed that they had this authority.
Okay. So by 1895, it was already in place.
Yes. They were quashing the authority of the jurors to nullify bad laws once again.
Okay.
By holding them in ignorance as far as possible. And you cannot exercise a right if you do not know you have it.
Of course. Is it clear what precipitated that power grab?
In that particular instance, It's not clear from that one case, but it is clear if you look at the introduction of federalism after the Civil War and the federal government's hunger, need, compelling need to consolidate its power to avoid another civil war, to exert its power to the extent that it would not be questioned, to set the Supreme Court up as the interpreters of the Constitution rather than as the enforcers of the Constitution. And now that's a big leap across a great chasm for the Supreme Court, which happened at that time.
Okay, so it was the Civil War, really, that precipitated this power grab.
I think it had gone on before then as well. It certainly was part of what happened during the Whiskey Rebellion and the Fugitive Slave Act.
Right, but the Civil War really sent it home for these guys. They said, that's it, right?
I think it was an exacerbating force
mm-hmm.
in this compelling need and desire to consolidate as much authority, as much power as possible, both to government as opposed to the private citizens. So you wanted to make power be centralized within not only government, but within central government. And that would be within the federal government, wouldn't it?
Yes.
So then we had, during that same time, was about the same time as there was the first attempt to put in, I think, a national income tax on the federal level, which was not successful at that time. Turn of the century, we're dealing with a nation in flux. We're dealing with a nation where there are still people who are angry and bitter that they were not allowed to peacefully divorce themselves from something they considered to be an abusive relationship. And we are talking about people who did not consider themselves to be abusers, but considered themselves to have a more enlightened view and a more centralized concept of how government should be administered.
Okay.
And so that's what was going on. There was this tension of where power would be centered at the state level, within the individual, within local and state level governments, or within this consolidated, massive federal government. And that was all going on around the turn of the century. This was a huge struggle. It was a struggle of both legal dimensions and moral dimensions within this country.
This is a fascinating time here because so much of what we're experiencing today was created during the turn of the last century. Isn't that right?
Well, at least several of the significant components were put in place at that time.
Right.
So that by the time 1920 rolled around, the federal government was able to pass a law which completely denied individual body ownership and said that it was against the law for people to buy and sell and consume alcohol. Prohibition began.
Mm-hmm.
And so the federal government took upon itself this mantle of morality, which, by the way, completely negated part of the original vision of the founding of this country, which a fellow who was at Harvard named Robert Nozick wrote a book called Anarchy, State, and Utopia about how we had this opportunity to experiment with different types of social order in this nation because we had all these different entities involved.
Right.
And so suddenly, here was, perhaps we could say that 120 years later and longer, the government is finally getting revenge on the Whiskey Rebels.
That's pretty heavy.
But you see what has happened during this intervening 120 years, from the time of the Whiskey Rebellion until Prohibition was passed at the federal level, the shift of power from people being able to freely transform their agricultural products into something that was more easily transportable and saleable and storable, into having that product prohibited from consumption. Isn't that a fascinating progression?
It's very fascinating. The Whiskey Rebellion was, I guess, 1791 to 1794, is that right?
Correct.
And that happened primarily in western Pennsylvania?
It did, yes.
Okay.
And those are corn farmers, by the way.
Right.
Had an ancestor who lived there who had a letter from George.
You mean the George?
Yes.
Okay. Letter, wow.
Anyway.
Well, that's impressive.
So I know quite a bit about the Whiskey Rebellion because of that.
Right.
Anyway, so now we're up to 1920, and the politicians have enacted a law which says that people are prohibited from consuming certain things. Let's talk about that for a moment, because this is a huge centralization of power to a central government and giving it also the authority and the power to enforce this law using force, using coercive means.
You said from consuming certain things.
Yes.
Didn't laws exist prior to this that prevented citizens from consuming certain things?
Well, I don't know of any particularly. Let me think.
Okay.
Because drugs were not prohibited
right.
in the early part of the history of this country. Marijuana was not prohibited. Cocaine was not prohibited.
Right. In fact, George Washington smoked hemp.
Well, so did Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
And you can read Thomas Jefferson's writings and tell the difference.
Yeah.
and he was very much better at making connective relationships between points of social order, I think, when he was smoking hemp. But I think sometimes he also got a little confused. So
well,
I don't
that
know
happened.
If it was a good or a bad thing, really.
He was still a giant.
He was, wasn't he?
Yes.
So by 1920, the federal government, again, had explicitly expressed, articulated, and enacted as fact that it had control over the bodies of individual human beings.
Okay.
Slavery was reinstituted in the United States of America.
Right.
Because slavery is, in fact, that attribute that you do not have control over your body, where you can put it, what you can do with it, how you dispose of the fruits of your labor, etc.
Okay, so just to recap, prior to 1920 prohibition, the federal government did not try to enforce the kinds of laws that prevented a citizen from consuming a certain product. Generally, there might have been communities, I guess, because like you said earlier, Salem was a theocracy. There might have been smaller communities that prevented certain products from being consumed.
Dry towns.
On the local level,
mm-hmm.
that might have happened. But on the federal level, it didn't happen.
So this was a political power grab. This was a consolidation of power on a completely different level. And how did juries come to play during this time?
Okay.
Juries refused to convict people who were brought to trial for buying, selling, or consuming alcohol. They simply refused to convict. And so the government finds it exceedingly difficult to get convictions of people who are brought to trial for buying or selling whiskey or consuming whiskey or for having whiskey in their possession.
Okay.
Prohibition is not a popular law.
Okay.
And finally, the politicians get the message, and prohibition is repealed in 1933.
Well, it took a while, though. That's 13 years.
It did, but it took a while to get it enacted as well.
Okay.
There was much lobbying going on to pass prohibition. And so this noble experiment in government ownership of the human body
right.
is set aside, only to be replaced with many other laws which began to prohibit the consumption of all sorts of things. Smoking of marijuana, which many people back then used for medical purposes, by the way.
Right.
Cocaine, which I think was one of the original ingredients in a very popular soft drink.
Let me guess. Pepsi? No, I'm kidding.
But anyway, so the government had to give up on prohibition because, darn it, those jurors knew that they could veto this law.
Right.
But they kept the alcohol federal agents on, and they expanded their mission, the scope of their mission, to include firearms, tobacco. And suddenly one needed to get federal permission for tobacco growing.
Right.
And some things were outlawed. And so the government was, again, encroaching upon the individual rights of humans and our human right to have control of our own body. Now, by the time, remember now we're up to 1933 and looking beyond that a little bit.
Okay.
And we have a couple of wars going on.
And a Great Depression.
We had a Great Depression, a couple of wars. And by the time we get up to the politicians displaying their hubris incredibly with the Vietnam-era war.
Right.
We have Vietnam-era protesters
okay.
encouraging young men to escape to Canada, and many of them themselves burning their draft cards, refusing to be drafted, to go kill people who have never threatened them, who live in almost a Stone Age culture with water buffalo plowing their rice fields.
Similar to today, except there aren't any water buffalo, there's camels.
Yes. Thank you for seeing that parallel. Vietnam-era protesters between 1960 and 1970 were very often brought to trial by the federal government on all kinds of fairly harsh charges, such as conspiracy to interfere with the federal government, conspiracy to interfere with an officer of the federal government, you know, destruction of government property, burning your draft card, that sort of thing.
Right.
Fugitives. It wasn't a Fugitive Slave Act, but it amounted to the same thing, didn't it?
Yes.
When they wanted to pursue fugitives who did not want to learn how to kill other people or go kill other people and ran away to Canada.
Right.
And they wanted them brought back. They were fugitives from slavery to the federal government. The juries refused to convict these people.
Mm.
It was elegant. I must say it was elegant for a very special reason, which I'll get into in a minute.
Okay.
Today, We see jurors refusing to convict people in income tax cases,
right,
in medical marijuana cases, in firearms cases where someone has in their possession a firearm. They're not using it or threatening anybody with it or even brandishing it, but they have in their possession a firearm which is not duly licensed. In other words, they haven't paid the local government the proper bribes and paperwork, filled out the proper paperwork and paid the proper bribes to enable them to possess a firearm.
Exactly.
And so jurors are refusing to convict. And the reason I wanted to mention the Vietnam-era protesters specifically,
okay,
and one case of a young man who was a Vietnam-era protester who stood before the jury and said, I have a conscience, which is why I am doing what I did. And if you have a conscience, you will not find me guilty. And he sat down. Many years later, his daughter, who is also a peace worker, was one of the members of the St. Patrick's Four in New York State who drew their own blood and trailed it across the walls of a military recruiting center to protest the government recruiting young people so that they could teach them how to kill other young people whom they did not know and had never met and meant no harm to each other, mm-hmm, other than the government trained them to do this and sent them off to kill each other. And these people were protesting that we lived under a government that would engage in and promote such atrocities as taking its own young, innocent citizens, peaceful citizens, training them to kill other people and sending them to far-off places to kill these other people.
Has anything changed?
Very little has changed, has it? And so this wonderful woman whose father had said to the jury, I did this based on my conscience, and you must find me innocent based on yours, and sat down. She stood before a jury in New York, a federal jury, where she was being charged with destruction of federal property, interfering with the duties of a federal officer, conspiracy to commit something horrible.
Right.
And she said the same thing to them. And the jury refused to convict her.
All right.
They found her and her fellow defendants all not guilty.
That's, what about her dad?
Well, her dad was found not guilty by his jury as well.
Oh, great.
So, and that's why I said this is such an elegant repetition. I found it a beautiful story that there was a family with the courage of their convictions to put themselves, put their bodies, their futures, their lives on the line and expose the evil,
right,
being perpetrated by government against innocent people who would like to merely be left alone to live in their homes, care for their children, live quiet, productive lives, carry on their day-to-day activities, sing in the church choir, perhaps,
right,
plant flowers, and take care of people who needed their care and love and concern. We are not born to be evil, warmongering murderers, unless we're psychopaths or something. We're born to be peaceful, productive people,
mm-hmm,
who live together in communities, cooperatively, and engage in voluntary activities for the betterment of all. Now, juries, I'm saying all of this to you for a reason. When a jury comes together, keep that image of these people who live, and I'm not saying that we're hobbits, but you know, you can carry some of that spirit with you. As we talked about the people who are selected for jury duty, even though they are threatened with punishment if they don't come. So they are there under coercion.
Yes.
They come anyway. And I know this because I talk to them almost daily. I talk to jurors all the time. They come in and they realize that they are there to serve a higher purpose than government. They are there to serve the purpose of justice. And justice is not an attribute of government. I think we've just established that in the last few minutes of our conversation.
Mm.
Justice is an attribute of the individual.
This has been lost, though, since, I guess, officially 1895, hasn't it?
Well, they certainly tried to make it seem as though it wouldn't happen, and they've done all they can to malign jurors, take away their authority, and in fact treat them, when you go to jury duty, you're often treated with a great deal of contempt and disrespect.
In Sparf versus the U.S. in 1895, they ruled that jurors do not have to be told of their jury nullification rights because they already know of them. Were they right? Did they already know of them? And what about today?
They were right in the sense that back then most people did know of that authority. Remember, this country was founded and the Bill of Rights was written with the assumption of that authority for each and every individual juror based on a tradition that goes back to the Magna Carta.
So they knew about it because they were telling them about it, right?
Judges often did tell them about it, but people knew about it because they learned about it from their tutors in their schools, which then were often associated with churches, mm-hmm. where they wanted them to understand their role as a person who lived in a particular form of government and why it was a grave and serious responsibility okay. that jurors must consider the law as well as the facts and keep the government in check and make sure that justice was truly done for all sides, for all parties.
And that's just not taught anymore.
It isn't taught at all. Obedience to authority, if not worship of authority, and government by personality rather than government by principle is the system under which we live today.
And they got away with it, it seems like.
Well, I think, you know, you have to consider that children go to government schools.
Right.
So they have an agenda within a government school. But back to jury.
Yes.
When you go into serve on a jury, and jurors know that they are there to serve this higher concept of justice more than they're there to serve the government.
Right.
They usually understand that. But these days, they don't always understand that because, again, they've been through government schools. They've been taught that they must be obedient to government. The government is the highest authority in their lives.
Right. Big brother.
That God has been cast out. Our Creator has been cast out as the highest authority in our lives. That our sense of morality is now muddied by our sense of what is legal
right.
under government. And so we have lost, in many cases, people have lost their moral compass. Because when you have fake lodestones, if I may use that metaphor, set up around your moral compass has a difficult time focusing on its primary precepts, which would be recognition of the human rights of all human beings, all individual human beings on this earth.
It's a good place to start.
And the moral imperative to treat every other human being as we would want to be treated. These are very simple concepts.
The golden rule.
Yes, but they have been replaced with, you should do what the authorities tell you because they are in authority. I remember when I was a very young person and we were protesting the Vietnam War, and there were all these bumper stickers which said, question authority.
I remember those.
And I think we need to keep doing that. And an informed juror, which is why FIJA is here, to inform jurors, an informed juror will know that they must question the authority in the courtroom. They must enter that courtroom with skepticism. They must understand that of the people in the courtroom gathered together for this process of justice, of administering justice,
right.
they may be one of the few people in that courtroom who is not an agent of the government, who does not receive a paycheck from government, who is not employed by the government, or whose livelihood is not controlled by government.
Well, they get paid, don't they, for sitting on the jury?
Well, but not very much. They have another job somewhere else,
right.
as a lumberjack or a nurse or a waitress or an engineer. They probably don't work for government. Think about the actors in the courtroom. Who writes the checks? Where do these people get their pay? The policeman,
mm-hmm.
the coroner, the prosecutor, the judge, most of the court officials, the bailiff, the person in charge of seating the jury.
Mm-hmm. The stenographer.
The stenographer. Who pays those people?
Right. Taxpayers.
Yes, but, well, the money is stolen from taxpayers, but it's paid to them by the government, isn't it? And the people who are supposed to be there serving the people who pay them, the taxpayers, don't really see that because the institution has been set up so that the hierarchy of accountability is all through government institutions. It doesn't go back to the people. You nor I can fire a judge. But what we can do when we serve as a juror is that we can understand that there is very often collusion among the police, the forensics experts, the
sure.
prosecutor, and the judge. And this is all coming out now. I mean, I'm not saying anything people don't know.
That's right, exactly.
It's in the news every day.
Right.
But so the juror must be skeptical of this dance of courtroom mechanization that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And they must remember why they are there, and that is to serve justice and to be true to that first moral imperative, which is to protect the human rights of an individual.
Right. Now, you're talking about judges. Something amazing that we talked about earlier last week was that many judges are not even aware of what jury nullification is, nor are lawyers. Am I accurate in saying that?
I think you're accurate in saying that. Many of them know about it and dismiss it, or they will tell you it's unlawful. We receive jury instruction booklets from many localities where it says, quite frankly, in black and white, jury nullification is against the law.
Is jury nullification against the law?
It's not against the law. It cannot be against the law. Any action you take based on your conscience and your sense of morality in the situation where you are a juror cannot be against the law. It would be against the law if you were taking a bribe to render a verdict, wouldn't it?
Sure.
But then you've already violated your conscience by taking a bribe, so violating it again probably won't hurt very much. As a federal district judge in Texas once said when we were having a discussion, well, if I were a defense attorney, I would stand up and look each of the jurors in the eye, leaning across the bar, you know, the front of the jury box there, he said, and I would say to them, you know when you're doing right and you know when you're doing wrong. You can feel it in your gut. In this case, do the right thing.
Right.
That was a federal judge who said that's what he would say if he were the defense attorney.
And I'm sure there still are a lot of good federal judges out there who probably inform juries about their nullification power, aren't there?
No.
Oh, great.
There are very few judges at all, anywhere, who inform jurors about their nullification powers, because nullification powers of the jurors is, again, remember we've been talking about that tug of war, the power between government and the individual?
Mm-hmm.
And the judge works for
the government.
Right.
And he was a lawyer, most likely.
Yes.
Right.
And he went to law school, and he was not necessarily taught to do justice. He was taught to win.
Right.
And as a human being, we have self-interest. We want to build our careers, advance ourselves, gain a good reputation. Many prosecutors plan to run for political office.
Sure.
They have a vested interest in consolidating the power to government, not distributing it evenly between the people in government, or even having the people have more power, which is what was supposed to happen in our form of government. So that's what's going on these days. What's going on these days with jurors is that fewer and fewer of them are ever hearing about their authority and responsibility to render a verdict based on conscience and to examine the law to make sure that it is a fair law that does not violate the rights of any human, and to ensure that if this person is truly dangerous and has harmed another individual, that they are being sent to a prison so that they can no longer wander free in their community or in society and harm another person. But if this person is only being brought to trial because they happen to have in their possession in their home two rifles which weren't properly registered with the proper authorities, but they have harmed no other person, then they are not a criminal. And jurors need to understand that bright line that exists between criminal acts and acts that simply violate the whims of some politician who was able to pass some statute, whether it was prohibition, the Fugitive Slave Act, or against Vietnam-era protesters or other war protesters. Jurors need to understand the distinction, that there is a distinction, and it is, in fact, a true difference.
Right. They are clearly the final check on power, aren't they?
Exactly. And citizens were always meant to be the final check on power. And again, when you're on a jury, it is the most powerful vote you have. You can vote in an election. You could even vote on a grand jury. There are more grand jurors, so your vote is a little bit more diluted. But when you serve it on a petit juror, especially in a criminal case, your vote carries a great deal of impact, especially for the person who is on trial.
Sure.
So that's why FEJA is here, to inform everyone that they have, when they serve as a juror, this doesn't mean you should go around to be a scofflaw, but when you serve on a jury, you have a moral obligation to examine the law, examine the evidence, be skeptical, and be watchful for any collusion amongst the government agents present in the courtroom. But you have a moral responsibility to make sure that you are protecting, to the best of your ability, the human rights of the people on trial against the government tyranny and the government employees' thirst and ambition for power and position that often accompanies those opportunities for people who are employed by the government.
Right. And the Fully Informed Jury Association, I'm looking at your website right now, that's FIJA.org, FIJA.org. So if you want to check this out, you can go on the internet and go to their website. Now, you said earlier that obviously you speak with a lot of jurors, as you said, you speak with judges. Do jurors, do citizens call you up?
Yeah.
Okay, tell our listeners about why someone would call up FEJA and speak with someone.
Recently, a woman called because she was seated as a juror in a case where a young woman was charged with soliciting an undercover policeman with a prostitution case. The young woman was charged with soliciting. She was the mother of two children. Her husband had left her and cleaned out their accounts, and I'm setting up the story here for you.
Good.
And the woman said, yes, she had in fact done this. It was the first time she had ever done this, but she did not have any money left to feed her children. And this was the only thing she could do. She had been married since she was 16. And she was 19 at the time. The juror felt that the woman did not deserve to be punished, but needed to be helped.
That makes sense.
And said as much to the other jurors and said that the treatment she had received from the police when they arrested her, apparently another policeman arrived. She was placed under arrest. They read her her rights. She was reaching into her purse to get her cell phone because she wanted to call her children or her mother to let her mother know who had her children that she would not be returning home. She was being taken to jail.
Right.
She had asked them, are you taking me to jail? And they said yes. And at that point, she reached into her purse to get her cell phone, and she was tackled and thrown to the ground.
Oh, my God.
Because they said she made a dangerous move reaching into her purse. She could have been reaching for a weapon.
Right.
And so she had already been put through a whole lot, plus all this embarrassment of this desperate young woman. The juror felt that she should not be found guilty, that she should be not only found not guilty, but she wanted to take her to her church so the girl and her children could be helped.
Right.
And the other jurors all argued with her and said, no, she broke the law. The judge said, if she broke the law, we have to find her guilty. She was soliciting. We have to find her guilty. The judge said so. The juror who called me finally caved in and voted guilty because she said everybody was getting really angry with her. There was a lot of hostility, and she was under a lot of pressure, and so she caved in. She went home, talked with her husband, and he said, well, you need to go back and tell the judge you've changed your mind or something. And they didn't know what to do. So they looked up something about jury instructions or something, and they found Fija. She got in touch with me, and she told me what had happened, and she was crying.
Right.
And she said, I know I did something that was unchristian, that violates everything I believe, that this is not how we're supposed to treat people in situations like this. This girl had not hurt anybody. She wasn't trying to hurt anybody. She wasn't a threat to anybody. And I just wanted to grab her and hug her and take her to our church so we could help her and her children and pay their rent. We would have taken up a collection for her. And she said, and I did the opposite. I betrayed her. And she said, I felt like Judas.
Right.
What can I do?
So people approach you almost like they're in confessional.
Very often. I hear from people who have been under a lot of pressure to change their verdict because they're trying to vote from conscience in a room full of people who are voting from appeal to authority because they've been taught that in government schools all their lives.
So we've been brainwashed. They've won, have they?
No, they haven't won because I'm still here talking with you, and you're still here talking with me.
I know, but we know it. But you think that after all these years of brainwashing that we can get the people back to understanding?
I believe that, we can because I believe in basic human goodness. I don't believe that brainwashing is ever entirely thorough. I believe that every human being has a spark of conscience and a spark of divine consciousness within them, and that once they are told the truth, they will follow it. We cannot do better until we know better.
On your website, Fija.org, Fully Informed Jury Association, you have some tabs at the top: home, news, activism, forum, media catalog, library, state contacts. And there's state contacts. I went through it all. I think about 45 states have state contacts.
Yes, and often more than one, yes.
Right. And support Fija and videos. Now, I was curious, there are some brochures that you can hand out to, I guess, jurors or potential jurors or any citizen that you'd like to interact with. But isn't there a problem with that? Haven't there been arrests where you're just trying to apprise people of their rights, but the good old federal government doesn't like that, do they?
We're back to that push and pull, aren't we? That tug
of
war between power and where influence and power reside. And so, no, the government doesn't particularly like it. And let me say this about the brochures. People can go to our website, click on the library tab, and you'll find our brochures there. You can print them out free. If you would like a package of our brochures and information on your authority as a juror mailed to you, by the way, we do have an 800 number people can call, and that's 1-800-TELL-JURY with one L, 1-800-TELL-JURY, 1-800-835-5879. Now, back to what goes on with people handing out literature.
Yes.
Very often, there's no conflict. People can hand out our literature. It's not case specific. It's simply information on their authority as a juror. We suggest that people hand it out to everyone, not just to potential jurors and, you know, standing outside the courthouse. The federal government recently has made most federal property limited speech zones.
Okay.
That means that you no longer have the right to exercise free speech on federal property. And so people who want to hand out CEJA literature around, say, federal courthouses
right.
are often prohibited, occasionally attacked and arrested for exercising their right to free speech. So we encourage you to go somewhere else safe. We don't encourage you to be attacked and arrested by government agents.
No, it would be nice if they put up signs, though, you know, this is a limited free speech zone.
Well, we've actually had some people who've been carrying those signs themselves and standing just outside and saying, warning, when you cross the line onto this sidewalk, you will be entering a limited speech zone.
So these brochures can result in somebody being arrested.
Well, not the brochures per se, but trying to hand them out in limited speech zones can result in someone being arrested. And to the best of my knowledge, limited speech zones are only being enforced by the federal government. Again, we're talking about that tug of war, that compelling need to centralize all power.
Right, that they're winning. They're winning that tug of war.
Well, they're not winning, are they?
I don't know. It seems like they are.
I think that what they are doing when they have these limited speech zones is that they are responding out of fear. They are flailing about in their weakened condition in a state of fear against a citizenry which has become more active, more informed, and more vocal than it was 20 years ago.
They're in their death throes.
I think so. And if they don't reform, a larger reformation is going to occur in this country, and I think that we will go back to a more constitutional form of government. And part of that constitutional form of government is the authority of the jury.
Right. This is something very important that really folks need to pay a great deal of attention to. On your website, Fully Informed Jury Association, that's FEJA.org, I see right on the homepage, Jury Rights Day is September 5th. Do your part. What is that all about?
Dave, do you remember earlier when we were talking about William Penn, who later founded Pennsylvania?
Absolutely, of course.
And when he was still in London, he was preaching the Quaker religion on the sidewalk because they had locked the doors to the Quaker church,
okay.
the Quaker meeting place. He was arrested because it was against the law then to even mention other religions than the Church of England. This was after a big fight and, you know, England had left the Catholic Church, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot more politics, a lot more consolidation of power going on in all kinds of ways then.
Right.
So William Penn was arrested and taken to trial for preaching the Quaker religion, and the jury refused to find him guilty. And the judge threw them into prison because they refused to follow the judge's instructions of finding William Penn guilty. Well, the foreman of the jury was one of the people who was thrown into prison, and so they appealed to the Court of Common Pleas, to Justice Vaughn, and that's when Justice Vaughn issued the ruling that said, even if the jurors disobey the judge, they cannot be punished for their verdict. There is, in fact, a plaque outside of Old Bailey, the Hall of Justice in London.
Okay.
Commemorating this ruling and the William Penn trial, because here are some things that established not only in England, but also for our country later on under the common law. It established freedom of religion. It established the right to free speech in public. It established the fact that jurors could not be punished for their verdict and that they had the authority to render a verdict based on conscience.
Right.
And to refuse to enforce bad laws. So we celebrate Jury Rights Day for all of those reasons. But because we are the Fully Informed Jury Association, we especially celebrate Jury Rights Day because it established the tenet that jurors cannot be punished for refusing to enforce bad laws and refusing to follow the instructions of the judge, that they must take the law as it is given to them.
Okay, so what happens on Jury Rights Day?
Well, we have special programs going on across the country. People like you will be putting up these interviews.
Right.
Some people dress up in colonial costume and hand out FEJA pamphlets.
Oh, that's great.
There are Jury Rights Day parties. We have sent out 25 packets for Jury Rights Day to 25 different states, maybe more than that in packets, but 25 states at least where we have FEJA people involved.
Okay.
We'll be having celebrations of Jury Rights Day. Very often, governors sign proclamations making September the 5th a Jury Rights Day for the entire state, officially.
Mm-hmm.
I think we just received one from Connecticut, and we had earlier received one from New Hampshire. I'm expecting another one from Alaska. Sarah Palin signed one, by the way.
That was nice of her.
And it was interesting because when she was asked by some people in Alaska if she would sign a Jury Rights Day proclamation, someone on her staff called our office and said, we need more information. This is very interesting. We don't know about this. And so we sent a whole package of information to Sarah Palin, and she signed the Jury Rights Day proclamation the same day she accepted the candidacy for vice presidency.
Wow. How many states recognize Jury Rights Day?
over the last 20 years, many states have, I don't have a count on that, and it moves. You know, some years, some states recognize it and some don't, and sometimes mayors recognize it or legislators, you know, local representatives recognize it.
Right.
But I'm holding here in my hand right now the one from the governor of Connecticut, Jody Rell. May I read it to you?
Please.
By Her Excellency Jody M. Rell, Governor, an official statement, State of Connecticut. Whereas September 5th, 2010 will mark the 340th anniversary of the day that the jury in William Penn's trial refused to convict him of violating England's Conventicle Acts, which forbid other religions. That doesn't say it in here. Despite clear evidence that he acted illegally by preaching a Quaker sermon to his congregation, and whereas by refusing to apply what they determined to be an unjust law, this jury not only served justice, but provided a basis for the United States Constitution's First Amendment rights of freedom of speech, religion, and peaceable assembly, and whereas September 5th also commemorates the day when four of Penn's jurors began 9 weeks of incarceration for finding him not guilty. Their subsequent release and exoneration established forever the English and American legal doctrine concerning the rights and responsibilities of juries, and whereas the Sixth and Seventh Amendments were included in the Bill of Rights to preserve the right to trial by jury, which in turn conveys upon the jury the responsibility to defend with its verdict all individual rights enumerated or implied by the United States Constitution, including its amendments. Now, therefore, I, M. Jody Rell, Governor of the State of Connecticut, do hereby officially declare September 5th, 2010, as Jury Rights Day in the State of Connecticut.
That is impressive. When was that dated?
I just received this today, so she signed this within the last few days.
She sent that directly to the Fully Informed Jury Association?
Someone in her office sent it. I don't think she sent it herself.
Right. No, no, but that's what I mean. Yeah, sure, of course. Yeah. That's impressive.
We already have one from New Hampshire this year.
Live free or die. It's not a hopeless case then, is it?
It's never a hopeless case if you're still alive, is it?
No. No.
We are fortunate to live in times when we, as individuals, have an impact upon the process and direction of humanity. We are very fortunate to live at this time.
You're right. You're right, Elo.
And I'm taking as much advantage of that as I can.
You know, I want to thank you so much for the time we spent. It was so enlightening for me, and I'm sure listeners will really appreciate what you had to say and what you taught them about, because this information is part of this country. It's part of what our founding fathers wanted us to carry forward, what they set down.
It is part of our birthright.
Right. The Fully Informed Jury Association, FIJA.org. This information, I would imagine, is not carried on the mainstream media, is it?
Occasionally it is. There's even been an article in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. Occasionally the mainstream media cannot ignore what's going on, and they pick it up and report it, and we find sympathetic reporters. So we're happy with that. And I must add one comment here. I'm not sure today that the mainstream media exists anymore outside of the internet.
Absolutely. No, 100%. I've read enough books, and I've spoken to enough authors and enough academics and enough researchers to know that the mainstream media shuts out most alternative views that are not looked upon in a favorable fashion to the, unfortunately, the federal government, because the mainstream media needs access to these individuals, and the only way they can get access, they've found, is by doing what they want.
They're also licensed by the government.
Right.
But just as the Gutenberg Press enhanced and caused the fluorescence of the Reformation in Europe, the internet is causing the Reformation and fluorescence of civility and a new era of civilization all over the planet Earth. So
that's right.
Here we are. Let's go do it.
We're doing it. We're doing it. Hopefully the government, the federal government, isn't going to pass that internet kill switch legislation that was introduced by Senator Lieberman. Because if the internet does get to the point where we can educate people instantly, then you could be sure that the federal government wants to have a kill switch in place where they can shut it off and throw us back into the dark ages. But let's hope that doesn't happen. And Elo Jones, Executive Director of the Fully Informed Jury Association, FIJA.org. September 5th is Jury Rights Day. Elo, thanks so much for taking the time and the energy to explain all this fascinating information. It was a great experience for me.
Thank you so much for interviewing me, and it was delightful visiting with you, and I hope we have a chance to do this again sometime.
That would be great. Thanks, Elo.
Thank you, Dave. Bye.